Know what to do, Jill.
We got it.
The main thing we're focusing in our budget meetings is what changes people need are asking for with regard to 26 in relationship to what they had into 2025.
Fair enough. Okay. I'll try to be as succinct and I'll try to accommodate. I know I'm coming before the board, and I'm making some pretty significant asks compared to other departments, probably. And I recognize that. Okay. And I want to, recently with that email conversation, I was reminded a little bit about the statutes. Okay. And this being my own little background, I kind of went back to the statutes and started moving forward from there. Okay. And so I just wanted to talk just shortly about that. Okay. But before I do, I really want to acknowledge the difficult position you're in. And I want to make sure you understand that I understand that. Okay. You are set with a finite set of resources. And you are ultimately responsible for balancing, which I don't have that problem. Okay. I'm here from district court making a singular ask from you. I can be here to assist in the give and take, look for areas that I can cut in that budget consideration. But I'm here making an ask, and my ask is relatively large, and we'll go into why, hopefully. But I just want to acknowledge the fact that I recognize that you have a difficult task, and I have no preconceived notions on you accepting everything I ask for. Okay, because I recognize that you have to balance an array of needs of the community, of different departments to run and function. Okay, my issue here, and has always been before this board, is to be heard on my asks and the rationale for it. And that's where I found my nose in the statute. Okay, recently reminded that that's where it all starts from. And when I looked at it, and I looked at Title 3640 and the statutory framework, I was reminded of what I had called due process, okay? Administrative due process, government actions. And it's found in the legislative do's and don'ts, so to speak, of the statute. It is really designed, and the statutory framework is designed for transparency, fairness, and that adherence to the statutory framework assists specifically as related to the budget process in being heard, okay? And when I referenced 3640-71, which is this meeting and other meetings like this that are set, I arrived at the indication, and 70, I should say, that part of this is part of a public forum and the obligation we have to the taxpayers to be held accountable. Actually, more so me at this hearing than the board. This is informational. The board gets to ask questions, but the taxpayers get to be present and inquire about, in relationship to transparency, inquire about my ask as well. And given that the taxpayer, and one of the primary reasons for this hearing and the requirements for these hearings statutorily is a due process, administrative due process thing, I feel like I need to go into my budget considerations and why I'm asking for what I'm asking, even though I know that you have a bit of it before you already, okay? But I will be trying to sensitive to things that have been articulated prior in with regards to collective bargaining issues and things like that. So I will be sensitive to those issues because you have that information before you. Most of my goal here is to ensure that the rationale and reasons behind my asks are before the board, okay?
The court.
Huh?
You said before the court.
Oh, I did. Occupational hazard. Okay. So, the first thing I want to talk to you about is my request in relationship, or actually the rationale for my request. Okay. And it's a two-part rationale. And none of it has to do with this existing board. And I want to acknowledge that on the record as well. That district court for since as far as I can see, hasn't made very many asks of the board since 2008. If it's not asked for, it can't be given. Okay, so the numbers I'm about to discuss and go into have nothing to do with this existing current board because no one's asked you for anything or very little in terms of budgetary requests. And my request, as I said, is a little significant and it has to do with that relationship to that. And there's two aspects of this that I just wanted to dive into, and that is the department fundings. Okay, branches, governments. And when I ran the numbers, first let me start by saying the analysis is imperfect, for sure, because there's really no way to define how salaries are allocated, whether it's to increase salaries, whether it's to increase department employees in each department based upon the budget I was looking at. But it does reflect over time and the statistical data points over time a disparity from the lack of asking of district court, which can affect the operations of district court. If you quickly look down at some of the information I provided just by analyzing three departments, district court, the prosecutor's office, the clerk's office at a superior court, the board, and HR, we can see that the average increase since 2008 numbers range from approximately 94%, around that range, upwards to close to 200%, about 190% increase, which is normal over what represents a 16 to 18 year period that I looked at the numbers of salary increases, and that's specific to salary increases. Okay.
For the whole department?
What's that?
For the department?
For the departments that I was looking at. So when we're talking about salaries, it's the gross salary allocation each year as it increases from 2008. There was a recessionary period for about 2 or 3 years where it dipped below and went in a negative swing, and then it started coming up slowly.
When you say gross salary allocation, so in 2008, human resources, as an example, was two people. Human resources GSA today is probably what? Six, eight people.
That's right.
So are you comparing the two people to what two people were making compared to what
Nope.
eight
I'm
people were
looking
making?
at budgetary allocations to each department, HR for salary, prosecutor's office for salary, clerk's office for salaries, their total salaries, which is imperfect in the sense that it could represent more additional employees, increased salaries, and even departmental shifts. Okay. For example, what you're talking about HR in 2023, clearly there was a consolidation of different departments within HR, which went up to over 500% salary increase. I discounted that because it was an outlier and went with the figures pre-2003 to represent 190% increase in salary allocations. Okay. So I did my very best to be fair in the calculations and numbers. And any gross deviation change. For example, when I looked at the board, it looked like the salary allocations had to do with board and the support staff, but it looked like you took in like a county manager and other people and then severed that off into a separate department. Okay. So I did my best to account for things like that when looking at over the overall salary allocations. As I said, it's imperfect, but it is very representative when you get a significant difference in correlation. Because if you take a look at district court, 46 to 55% allocation since 2008, that means the salary allocation to district court is only 56 above a figure that was 18, 16 years ago. Okay, that's significant. And that's not your fault. That's not the board's fault because no one asked. Okay. But what that represents to bring it up to other departments on average would be between $350,000 to $1.3 million in salary allocations. That varies.
I think where I'm still needing to clarify is it sounds like it's a percentage of current expense allocation to the departments that you've looked at, but not necessarily just salary growth. So, for example, if new positions were added in
That's
there,
correct.
okay, so really what this conversation is about is the percentage of allocation to district court.
Absolutely.
Has it grown proportionately to the percentage of allocation to other departments? But it's not necessarily just direct salaries, it's staffing, it's all of the different costs.
Exactly. Hence my ask on the two fronts.
Got it.
Okay.
Okay.
Now the other point is something that from our last workshop I started taking a look at for the first time. And so you don't have that before you. And my numbers here are even less perfect because it was very difficult to dive into other county budgets in a timely manner to bring the information before the court, or again, the court, sorry, this board. But I will tell you
I'm
that,
judging you,
oh,
so
I know you
you are.
are. But the other one has to do with allocation to criminal justice, okay, as a county as a whole, okay? And I'm not here to prepare to talk to the entire budget, law enforcement, all that. My only primary concern is district court, okay? And if we look at the allocation of the overall county budget to district court, it reaffirms possibly what I'm saying about with the earlier figures relationship to the funding of district court. Because there's been not an ask again. And if you look, 1.29% of the county budget is allocated to district court. It was very difficult to find reliable statistical information for other counties because I didn't have time to go into each one of their budgets like I did with the county budgets. But the best information I could get was that. The average budget allocation for district court was somewhere between 1.4 to 5%. It's not a reliable figure. I guarantee you next year I'll have a better figure for you. Okay. But in terms of what looks like a 0.11, 1/10 of a percent difference, that would be approximately $1 million. Okay. For district court. Which represents pretty much the higher entry figure of what I was talking about with departmental allocations and salaries. Okay, so it's a I don't want to call it underfunding, but the difference between us and other counties based on that figure would be about a $1 million allocation if our budget was to increase by 0.11 to bring us to 0.14. Okay. Those are two of the bases I'm here for. And again, I reemphasize the fact that this is not a board issue here. This is the first time we're coming and asking for such a significant request. Okay. In terms of the difference and what's happening in court and the impact this has, it's pretty significant. Okay. Our case numbers are up and increasing, as you can see from the figures I put before you. Okay. When you do a comparative analysis of the number of cases district court handles, we're high volume. Okay, that means resources and staff. We're at 6,379 cases in total in a range of areas, comparatively to 1,871 cases at a superior court. Okay, and I could go into with each everybody about the differences between superior court and district court. They're not as dramatic as it relates to a court clerk as it might be from judges. Okay, and that's a pretty significant issue. And I would just urge the court or the board to think about something. Every time you get an ask from law enforcement, prosecutors, superior courts, it directly and indirectly impacts district court. Okay, more law enforcement, the vast portion of crimes, vast portion of crimes end up in district court. The community quality of life crimes end up in district court. So you add to the budget, you add to the staff or whatever resources of a different department, whether it's the prosecutor's office filing more cases, whether it's the law enforcement charging more cases, it ends up in district court, even in the sense that it ends up in superior court and you end up with more what I call reduced charges in district court to take advantage often of our probation department, who are far more active in monitoring an individual than DOC. Okay. And so these are considerations when you add to the budget of a different department, as has been happening since 2008, okay, that can impact district court that aren't accounted for. Now, the impact that it has had on court staff is dramatic, okay? It takes, I'll get into that. I'll just move on to the next topic I wanted to talk about, and that's the administrative position in relationship to what I'm some of the things I'm talking about here. And I know I've heard it said or heard it say that we're not hiring assistants for assistants in this time of restraint. Okay. But I want you to understand what an administrator for district court does. That's not an assistant position for a judge.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Not even close to an assistant position for a judge. Okay. It is a position that has a multifaceted function. Okay. It is, they deal with and supervise probation and staff, clerks and interns. They are similar to Superior Court Administrator in that they handle the facilities, securities, address the needs of the judges, scheduling, everything you can imagine that happens in Superior Court, an administrator here is going to do. The difference being is the administrator in district court supervises clerks. That would be your court. Clerk staff, okay, in Superior Court. It's just the way the government's created. It's the way a court of limited jurisdiction is created, different from that of a Superior Court. But it still fulfills much of the same role. And as I've tried to emphasize, that is a lot of responsibility for an individual. Beyond that, the administrator is responsible for supplies, ordering the regular function of court. They're responsible for reporting and in compliance with AOC requirements. That's the administrative office of the court. For example, right now we're going to be going through a computerization process that is so intensive. I walked in my administrator's office last month and AOC said, we're getting ready for your computerization in 2026. Here is a stack almost a foot high of paperwork, every line of cases that you need to review, pull, and deal with, because we need to computerize you and these issues need to be dealt with. Okay. Beyond that, they do the county finances. All of you have helped probably dealt with my administrator from the auditor's office to the board to facilities, because that's the person that's contacting to make sure things happen for the judges, for the staff, for everything from HR all the way up. It's a very responsible job. In terms of record retention, same thing. So what we have is one position, because it's a court of limited jurisdiction, with an administrator that has three times the volume of Superior Court, that's performing both the function of clerks and a Superior Court administrator. Okay. Now, it's not perfect. Okay. I recognize the Superior Court administrator handles juvenile detention and other things like that. And that's a very huge responsibility. But it highlights the need for support staff in this area and assistance in this area to the administrator. And if I was to kind of highlight that issue, I would have to say the administrator's position is not only this huge multifaceted thing, but it requires more knowledge than you could possibly imagine. And right now we're in the process, because we're short so staffed and the retention issue with our court clerks has had a 245% turnover in a 6-year period. We're having to train people with a year's experience or less, a year and a half experience. We've lost all our institutional knowledge. So our court administrator now has to function as a court clerk. Beyond all the financial responsibilities have and some of the things I've outlined, is having to function as a court clerk to make up the differences so training can happen effectively in cross-training.
Okay. I need to ask a question here.
Okay.
Does the district court filings not go through Deborah Van Pelt's office?
Nope.
Only Superior Court filings go through Deborah Van Pelt's office?
100%.
And then all the work that that clerk's office does for Superior Court is being handled in district court by district court staff?
Nope. We are completely different from Deborah Van Pelt's office. All filings are filed directly into by law enforcement, into the prosecutor's office, into district court.
So,
okay. Civil filings, district court. Civil restraining orders, which we handle the vast portion of, district court. That's our staff.
But would I file at your office? I'm sorry to interrupt, but would I file at your office, or I would go to the clerk's office here and file, and then they would direct it to you?
No, nope, you must file it in my office.
So your staff is doing all of Deborah Van Pelt's work for the
times three
for district court.
Yeah.
I'm not saying her work,
yeah.
but in
yeah.
my visual, all the paperwork was going through
yeah.
Deb's office.
Yeah.
It's not.
No.
Okay.
And I don't want to diminish what
I just didn't want to make the assumption.
No, and I don't want to diminish what they do. They do different things like domestic cases. They do civil cases that are pretty. The depth of them is great, and the filings are much greater. But the distinction and the volume are significant in district court, and it comes straight to district court. Okay. And let me add a little tweak to that. Currently, we contract with Oak Harbor, the city of Oak Harbor, Coopville, and Langley. District court is only required to do the county. Okay. Civil cases that fit within our subject matter jurisdiction. Criminal cases that are filed in the from the county, state patrol, sheriff's office. We contract with the city. We contact with the three cities, and we do their work for them. It defers the costs to this board of some of the costs, okay? But it increases our criminal volume quite a bit, as you can imagine, okay? And hence the level of volume that we have, okay? And so these are considerations. And I want to make sure you understand I'm not here trying to lecture. The failure of district court, not just in this county, but every county, has been to a failure to educate the board on what we do. Most people don't know completely the ins and outs of district court. Okay. We get that every day in court. And so part of my goal here is to educate you on how we work so you can make the decisions you need to and when you balance those revenues. Okay. So but we manage, as I said, three cities and the county. Okay. And those interested contracts defer some of the cost and pay the county for the services we provide. And that brings me to my next point, and illustrative of this and the difficulty and what happens when you do this and you contract with cities, what happens when you have administrative teams trying to manage this kind of level of flow is your outlines as it relates to in the executive summary. I use Skagit as an example. Now, Skagit is larger than our county, okay? But they contract, their district court contracts with Burlington, Mount Vernon, and the city of Anacortes. Cedar Woolley is on its own, okay? But it's under the same principle. Now, some of those cities that contract, they only contract for the court. They don't contract for court staff. They maintain their own court staff. But you can see the level of management team in that flow chart, okay? And the cost associated with managing city contracts, county contracts, and just the level of the teamwork it takes to maintain the finances. We report and cut checks and handle the revenue streams for not just the county, but the cities as well. And so that's part of the job. It's not just related to the county, but it's all done to defer some of the costs associated with the county that would or the county would absorb. So it's a pretty big ask on district court to function like this, not with the resources. Okay. And my goal there and the two charts I provided in the budget assessment and you can see the flow chart that I've attached to that budget summary. And I'll just kind of highlight it here. We've talked about the revenue stream there, and we talked, let's see here, to that. This here is the flow chart, okay? And when we're talking about funding for Skagit County District Court, you have a court administrator that reports to a Mount Vernon supervisor that handles the court clerks separate, that are funded by the city. But the Mount Vernon supervisor is effectively an assistant to the court administrator in district court. There's an assistant administrator associated with both Burlington and Anacortes. And there's an actual assistant to the district or the court administrator for district court. That is a pretty significant funding to make sure that those things that we talked about, a court administrator, gets done properly. So when we're talking about an assistant to an administrator, we're not talking about an assistant to an assistant. This is an assistant to a real administrator handling multiple contracts, multiple cities, and the county business as well. And it's a pretty onerous thing, but I've broken down in the following chart for you the comparable counties. Okay, if you look at the bottom on page exhibit F, you're going to see the breakdown of the total administrative teams for the counties of San Juan, Bellingham, Marysville, Calum County, Lewis County, Cowlitz County, Mason County, some of which are smaller. I put the number of judges there that they have to deal with and administer to. And you can see some are comparable, most are smaller. And you can see the overall funding in exhibit G in relationship to where we are compared to the other counties. If you're going down the list, you're $335,000 behind a larger county such as Skagit. We're $42,000 behind Marysville, $56,000 behind Lewis County, $56,000 behind Cowlitz County, Mason County, $35,000, which are much smaller jurisdictions than us. And so when I'm talking in the ask in relationship, not only to the administrator's position, but in relationship to adding an additional person, by the way, which was approved by this board several years ago for not an assistant, but an additional clerk. What we're talking about is a pretty a big ask, but a reasonable ask under the circumstances, okay, given the relationship to the expenditures, okay? And I just wanted to point out that it takes a team to manage this kind of department. And the assistant I'm asking for, in addition, would also come down and probably help the court clerks as necessary. Hence, you're not asking for an additional court clerk that I could have clearly justified asking for, okay? So that's my ask in relationship to those two. My other ask in relationship to the court clerks, I'd be careful that I don't talk about comps here, but you all have my comps, okay? And I have to say, and this is with all earnesty, I am a seasoned, I'm seasoned on the bench. I was even more a seasoned attorney, okay? I've been practiced in multiple jurisdictions. I have handled felonies, district court matters. I've handled million-dollar civil cases and everything. And I will tell you, as a person who's experienced, it is a thankless job, a court clerk. You could not get me to do this job for the responsibility and the pay. I mean, the stress, the anxiety that's created in that position for all they have to do and all they're responsible for is incredible. Some of my more experienced court clerks no more than a young attorney coming into my court. And the attorneys will tell you that, okay? They're more familiar with the procedures. They're more familiar with what they're looking at than an attorney. They're being paid pretty low, okay? And again, this has not ever been an ask. So it's not on this board. But I have to ask myself why. And I have reflected on this, and I think I've mentioned this to the county board. Several people on the county board in informal conversations. It's more of a reflection of what I've looked at, okay? And I understand the county clerks historically are a female dominated position. Okay. I consider this relationship to a gender gap. Okay. The court clerk's position is not even close to associated with the responsibilities and seriousness they have that they would if they were working for a different department. It's an enshrined pay scale that does not reflect the responsibility and the seriousness of that position. And so I just want to take a couple seconds to talk to you not only about why we have a 245% turnover rate.
That's over 6 years.
Over 6 years, yes. Sorry.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay. And but it's not just related to salary. It's related to retirements. It's related to other factors. And I don't want to go on the record saying it's anything but that. My best calculation is that at least five of that 245% out of 11 person staff have gone on to better paying jobs, okay, with the county, not with other departments, with the county, okay? And that relates to the department funding, okay? But it also is a high stress environment where there's obligations that can have significant impact. And this is part of the education that I hope to impart today, what a court clerk does, just as I did with his administrator, okay? A court clerk, first of all, I'd like to talk about the difference before I get into that, about the classifications as it relates to my ask. Most jurisdictions have clerk one, clerk two, and clerk three. Clerk one is someone who answers the phone. That's it, okay? Clerk two, by most job descriptions, is someone who answers the phone and handles what I would consider docketing, notices, information going out, okay? And the processing of funds. Clerk three, sometimes consolidated in clerk two, are those that deal with finances and in-court proceedings. It's important to know that our court clerks, when they start as one, start at a three everywhere else. They are in court. They are docketing. They are doing financials. They're doing front desk. And how does it impact us? What are they talking about? What's their job? Okay. It's a tremendous amount of information to learn. I would say to competently train a court clerk in that process in the past, it used to take 5 to 6 years just to get a court clerk up to speed on civil, criminal, docketing, all those kind of requirements AOC requires, departmental licensing requires, the law requires, okay? And now we're trying to do it in a year and a half because of 245% turnover rate where the average person, take out two of my staff members who are slated to retire really soon, take them out and my average court clerk has a year and a half to 2 years experience. That's it, okay? And that presents a tremendous stress, not only on the court, but on the individual, okay? Because they are functioning at a clerk three position because we can't afford not for them to function at a clerk three position, okay? Because of the retention levels, okay? Moreover, hence also my ask in relationship. I would like to get, and I'm asking that not for a clerk three position, I am asking for a legal specialist three position. And you can see the transition in other jurisdictions to name it something different because of that enshrined, what I call gender gap, is associated to a traditional female dominated position where the pay isn't commensurated with or matching the responsibility and the seriousness of their job. But when I talk about a court clerk that functions in Island County's capacity, let's talk about what it means to be in court. They are half a stenographer, okay? Like you would get in a superior court. Although our records are recorded on audio, what we're getting here is someone who has to make minutes and notes. To pick up a file 15 years after someone's bench warranted, you better know what's going on. And because we're recorded, we have recordings that go back cassettes, okay, and floppy drives and all sorts of things. Effectively, to handle our volume, you can't have inaccurate docketing minutes. Okay. And what does that mean? It sounds easy. Just record what the judge is saying. It's not. Okay. They have to learn a vast amount of information. I could start throwing out the jargon I say on the bench and no one would understand what I'm talking about. Okay. And they have to understand the context of what I'm saying and understand what to record and not record, because they're not taking verbatim. They need to know that if they don't write down probable cause when I make a finding, and someone issues and doesn't have that docket entry there 10 years from now and issues, or a year from now or 6 months from now, and they issue an arrest warrant thinking there's probable cause, but there's no docket entry that there's probable cause or the reference point to look back to, I might be issuing an illegal warrant to put someone in jail and the county gets sued for unlawful imprisonment. Okay. That's how serious it is. Okay. And that's not just to mention every proceedings. They're learning civil law. They're learning what a summary judgment is, what words I say that are important to make sure they can docket that in, docket so they can have reference point. They're learning, it's like a different language. Law school, going to law school mostly is about learning where to look things up and learning a different language and how to interpret it. And that's what the court clerks are doing, okay? Just to be in court to properly docket, to ensure that the judge has enough information the next time he's in hearing, or in 10 years if the person comes back into our jurisdiction on a warrant. I would note that there are many things, and beyond what generally people think about misdemeanor cases, there's 1077 hearings, there's 3.5 hearings, there's civil cases, as I said, summaries judgments, default judgment, replevin actions, impound laws, all sorts of things that they have to be cued into and understand to properly docket. Okay. And that's just being in court. Once they leave court, they need to file whatever's happened in court orders and understand whether they need to send them, whether it's to a DCR, a mistake's made and someone doesn't get evaluated and there's a risk to the community, a bench or a protection order that doesn't get filed properly or timely, or they haven't been able to check to make sure all the boxes are checked right and goes through, may not survive a criminal prosecution. Okay. They need to know so much just to function in court, just even in what to provide and what not to provide the person who comes to get their court date. And for example, notice, I can see a look at, so let me kind of explain a little bit more. Something as simple as me issuing a protection order, okay? And they need to know, well, the cases are moving along, exactly what they need to do with that protection order, okay? Have the individual come up, acknowledge, sign for it. Now you know that they know that the protection order is in place, okay? Now that case can be prosecuted if they violate that protection order. You don't want a flawed protection order either by a judge writing it flawed and or not providing notice, but they're part of the process in the courtroom. Okay, and they need to know that knowledge in order to have it done properly. Okay, being in court, that's why they're a clerk three in every other position, every county, because it's a responsible job and there's a lot of consequences that can flow from that. But that's not only the learning they're doing, they're learning the process to manage cases behind the scene, which means that they're AOC compliance, DOL reporting requirements. For an example, a failure to appear in court could trigger a bench warrant. Okay, not removing it properly in the system when they come on a bench warrant and quash those matters a bench warrant will remain out for their arrest. Okay, if they don't know how to process it right, even in the system, people can get arrested that shouldn't be arrested. Okay, and law enforcement, if they don't know how to process a no contact order when they get out, who to send it to, or restraint orders or DCR orders and things like that, it fails the community in a significant way. And I could go on, but I think you get the point. There is a lot of information to retain as a court clerk, okay? And just even dealing with the community at the front desk, is the judge allowed to hear this? Is it an ex parte communication? Do I have to put it in a folder so he can't hear it, so the case isn't in jeopardy, okay? Or there's not something inappropriate occurring. They have to know all this. They have to know the difference, and this seems simple. The difference from giving information to someone on a protection order and giving advice on a protection order. Make a mistake in there and we're going to be in trouble. Okay. But they want to give enough information to someone who needs a protection order And they have to have that knowledge and experience base to do that, so the person can avail themselves of our system to get protection they need it, whether it's a harassment situation, whether it's a sexual assault order, or whether it's a domestic protection. And this all takes time and knowledge, okay? And that's why I say a trained clerk, in most cases, is going to know most more than an entry-level attorney in practical practice. Okay. When we go to retention and back to the retention issue, as I've already kind of covered, it generally takes a long time to train. And we're in a situation we're doing cross training to try to make up. Right now, we've stemmed the flow of for the last year and a half, we've stemmed the flow of clerks leaving our office. But I can tell you right now, from my perspective, that is only going to last as long as the horizon looks brighter. Okay. And this is why I'm here asking for the ask for a clerk or a legal specialist 3 position. So I can move those people that I feel have accomplished sufficient training in a very compressed period of time. HR once told me when I was discussing pay and experience, they said, we've crafted our job descriptions based on experience. So people are rewarded for experience. I understand the benefit to that. I really do. But as it relates to that pay gap I was talking to, as it relates to the turnover rate and the comps I put before you, I would urge you to think about my ask, because it's really an ask related to the responsibility of the job, the gravity of the knowledge that's required to function as a job. When my folks can get 1 year of training, office experience, and get that knowledge, and they can catapult into different departments within the county that pay significantly higher, I've got a retention problem that I can't cure without assistance. Okay. And so I am really asking that we kind of change that historical gap and pay not just on experience, but based on knowledge and the responsibility associated with the position, and kind of allow me to have the discretion to move those folks that have fully cross-trained in that short period of time into a different status. That, incidentally, is consistent with all the other counties of what a Clerk 3 position does in court, processing paperwork, and answering the front desk and helping citizens who need help. Okay, not legal advice, but information. So that's my clerk position ask. The last ask I had was in relationship to probation officers and an assistant probation officers. I have just put out, and I have a probation officer who's been great, but is retiring. Okay, and will be retiring relatively soon. We put out an application. We had 7 or 8 applicants. We scheduled everyone except one, I think, for an interview. Not one person had any probationary experience. Zero. Okay. Only one person who works for us had any form of clerk experience. Okay. I don't know what to tell you. When we made the 7 interviews, only 2 people showed up. Okay. They were on whatever application. They're just putting it out there. We called them, we set up appointments, and they just didn't want to come. Okay. In fact, some of them canceled before we even could make an appointment. We called them and said, hey, look, we want an appointment. No. Okay. That's my issue I'm facing with trying to fill a probation officer 1 position. Okay. And even a 2, if you want to know the truth. But I won't go into that. That's another day. But it's important to understand what probation means to you. When we get kicked downs from Superior Court because probation monitors better, it's for a reason. Okay. This is a risk management concern to the county. Okay. Probation officers are required to monitor their negligence, not just in reporting, but their negligent monitoring can result in county lawsuits. You can look it up. Many counties have been sued over this. Okay. And it has to do with understaffing, and it has to do with too many cases on their profile. Our probation officers do pretrial monitoring and post-conviction monitoring and some diversionary monitoring. What does that mean? Pretrial monitoring. I have someone come in with a DUI, maybe two prior DUIs on their record. Now, this is an accomplished person who's been before the court before. They know how to evade monitoring very well. Okay. They go to probation for maybe alcohol monitoring in a pretrial status to make sure they're in compliance with the court order. If they're not, they're brought before the court, and other alternatives are considered, including custody for the failure to follow proper monitoring and safety protocols for our community. Okay. If I don't have the staff to properly monitor, right now I have an assistant whose job description is not part of that. And creates other issues in relationship to testimonial issues before the court, which I'll go into in a little bit, but I'll just drop it there for the moment and talk about what happens when they're not properly monitored. Okay. The difference between a DUI and a vehicular assault and a vehicular song or homicide is a wink of an eye. Well, homicide and assault end up in superior court. People generally don't start there. They don't start there with assault. They don't start there with drinking, crimes or anything. Most of the crimes out there are addiction oriented. Okay. So the failure to monitor can result in significant consequences, not only to the county's pocketbook, but also to the community in terms of safety. Okay. And we do our best. You're all probably not familiar with, but years back we had the Burlington shooter incident. They were being monitored by district court effectively, very effectively, and there was no issues with it. But this is kind of the things that I'm trying to talk about. What's today's misdemeanor, quality of life crime that significantly affects the community, may be tomorrow's in prison crime in superior court. Okay. And I think that's important to understand. In terms of post-conviction, this is our opportunity to rehabilitate, reduce recidivism, hold people accountable. And if we can't do that effectively because we don't have the resources, then it becomes a problem. Now, what does it mean to do that? It's not just calling someone up and coming in and having them test. Okay. It means that you're working and coordinating with treatment agencies, prosecutor's office, defense attorneys when there's violations. It means that you're bringing them into court, you're communicating with them monthly basis, and as the caseload grows, so does their responsibility, so does the risk. Okay. But it's active monitoring and it's active communication with all sorts of variations and issues that can arise through that. It's not just DUI and alcohol and substance, it's domestic anger management, you name it. It affects every reach in the community. Including, for an example, domestic. Our probation officer, and I think you may see on our webpage, I kind of get a head nod to one of our probation officers who recognized an underserved, but also a risk to our community for people that couldn't afford domestic. Our healthcare system doesn't cover it. Okay. And domestic treatment, is underserved and people were in violation and not getting the necessary cognitive treatment, that they needed. She went to training. She now puts on a free training for people who cannot afford it. Okay. We are trying and we're stretching self thin to make sure that this community is safe. And that's self-initiated. That wasn't even me. That was the probation officer's self-initiating when she recognized a gap in services and monitoring. And she wanted to make sure that happened for the county and happened for probation. And that was impressive. Okay. But this is the kind of thing that they're engaged in constantly. Okay. As I said, they're working with all sorts of technologies as well. They need to have the ability to testify in court competently. Okay. And that requires them equally to understand what they're testifying to, standards of evidence, the requirements that would be before the court. When I have a probation officer come before me, it's interesting, okay? But they come before me because someone's violated their conditions usually, or they're having problems getting into compliance with treatment or whatever other issues the court has ordered. Because court order goes into effect, they go on post-conviction monitoring. If they're out of compliance, they bring them back. Okay? They try to make sure they're successful in their rehabilitation. But if they're not having the success they need, they bring them back before the court, which is the notification process. Okay? And they have to be able to properly and competently testify in court, which means that they have to understand standards of evidence, the resources and technologies they're working with, what they can testify to, what they can't testify to, all sorts of things. These are not underskilled jobs. Okay? And I want to stress that. They have to deal with other states and interagency compacts in terms of probation, setting things up so people who are being monitored in these quality of life crimes of district court have a chance of success, okay, have a chance of rehabilitation, but are held accountable at the same time. It's no easy task, and it's a risk pool liability situation. So my ask in relationship to them is the assistant position I currently have be reclassified to have a broader job description. Because right now, it has no ability to testify in court. It has no training in that position.
Can I just stop you for a second? So I'm
Yeah.
in the right person at the right place. In your org chart, when you say the assistant person under probation, which position on
You're the
your org
probation
chart?
secretary, current probation secretary.
It's a probation assistant now, I think they call it.
It's called probation secretary in our org chart. Is that what
Oh,
you're referring
yes,
to?
absolutely.
Okay. And you want to change it to a probation assistant?
Two.
Two.
Yeah. Okay. I think the official classification is probation. I think I use the word secretary to underscore the fact that they're not even having probation officer job, but that they're actually they get delegated duties. But right now I'm in a situation the delegations of the duty to my assistant was becoming greater and greater to relieve some of the burden on the probation officers. I had to put a stop to it because it was a risk management concern. If it was outside the scope and they weren't trained for court testimony and there was an error and that person went out and committed a crime or got so hurt someone, I can't have someone that's not properly classified nor trained in that position that can take some of the burden off the probation officers. That's why I'm asking for that two position so I can have the probation officers delegate more responsibility and train that person appropriately.
So, Judge Kostick, with all respect, you've now addressed the board for about 50 minutes, which is about a half hour more than we let anybody else. But as
Oh,
you
thank
said,
you.
the district court has not had this opportunity before, and we appreciate that. But I know my colleagues and I have questions. Can I ask you to wrap up your presentation so that we can?
I'll wrap it up there. Most of what I've said is in there. I've highlighted the points I needed to. I have a couple of supplementals, but I think you're aware of why. I've been pretty detailed in the explanation of why.
Okay. Do you have any more questions?
So it took me a while to understand fully what you were requesting and which were new positions and which positions you're asking
Exactly.
to
Okay.
change categories. So I just want to be clear in my mind that you are requesting a new administrative assistant to the district court administrator. That's a new position,
Absolutely.
So
Not a
one new
requ
FTE.
One new FTE. And you're asking for an additional one FTE under the probation department.
No, he said he's not.
I think we're having a hard time understanding what is a request for a reclassification and
Exactly.
what is a request for a new position.
Okay, let me run through my asks then, okay?
Well, let's just do it real quick,
Okay.
not your whole list.
Okay.
So,
No. It's not the list. It's the highlights here. I'm
okay.
asking for a new position called legal specialist, which would be the equivalent of clerk three position.
Are you asking to add six new legal specialists or reclassify six positions into legal specialists?
Thank you.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I'm asking for no, I'm not. So could you rephrase that for
No,
me?
I understand what you're saying.
Well, you're from your HR, and I think
So
we have a breach
as
in
I
language.
listened to you and as I read your report,
Okay.
it was actually very difficult to figure out what are new positions and what are reclassifications.
New position
What
would
is it exist there, not where you have existing bodies, but where are you needing a brand new body in the room?
ah, excellent. Okay, now I understand. Sorry. My mistake here. The new position, and the only new position, is the administrative assistant position. No, sorry. Is the
legal specialist?
The
admin assistant to the district.
It's a brand new. It's the administrative assistant. In other words, the assistant to the administrator.
County court administrator.
Yeah, okay, that's the only brand
that's
new
the
position.
One new FTE.
Yeah. The new job description, the new type of job description that would be filled by current folks that I've requested, is the district court legal specialist, which would be the equivalent of a clerk three position. I just want to change the title to it to recognize what they've accomplished. The probation two assistant would be filled by a current employee that would be moving up to that.
So
with
your
a greater
probation assistant perhaps, or somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The salary increase, we know with the administrator, it's right there. To adjust the probation one to a two. I didn't really address that, but it's pretty clearly outlined why. The current two position doesn't have the authority to delegate and supervise the probation two assistant, which becomes, again, an issue in the administration. So I hope that covers it. I have made supplementals that are consistent with this that could replace this or otherwise, if you understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. The pay grade adjustment on the supplemental would be the equivalent of a legal specialist. I would prefer the legal specialist position to move people into, but it would be the equivalent of that.
I have one more question, Chair.
Sure.
My last question is, are all of the positions you're asking for reclassification represented? It's just a yes or no.
Are all they all represented?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. I believe so. Or I am not sure about the full who's in the union and who's not. This is not something I've gone down, but
yeah,
they can be a represented position. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
I think they would be. Jill, do you have any questions?
Probation assistant two, that doesn't exist.
That doesn't exist.
So you're asking for the creation of a new classification.
At a different pay grade, yes.
But your org chart has a probation officer too.
What's that?
Your org chart says probation officer too.
It's assistant and officer. It's two different things. He's not looking for another officer. He's asking for his secretary to be an assistant level two, so that the secretary would be making.
That position doesn't exist right now.
Yeah, just
so when you're saying creation of a new position, you're basically saying if somebody came in and answered the phones only, they would do this. If somebody came in and answered the phones and they were supervising different things or doing different workload, they would be hired at this classification. But there's not a classification to put somebody into to do that
exactly
work.
Exactly.
There's only a classification for the entry. That skill set can't move up. There's no way to take a step increase. There's no way to hire at a greater responsibility level. There's no way to recognize somebody at a greater responsibility level right now. And so you're asking for a step that somebody could move to if they perform these other functions.
Absolutely, with more increased job responsibility that allows me to utilize them better in assisting probation and relieving the stress on them.
Okay, so that's why you're saying it's new. It's because it's a new, not a new position, but a new opportunity within a position.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, what we focus on generally at this level is just the number of FTEs, the number of full-time equivalents in an office. And you are just asking for one additional full-time FTE.
That's correct.
That's right.
Okay. And a lot of adjustments in other things.
I understand. Okay. Any other questions, commissioners? Did you have anything else you wanted to share with us, General Costa?
Again, I just want to echo my appreciation for being heard. Okay, and that's all I had hoped for. I know that you guys really do have a difficult job in balancing it, and I don't envy you. Okay, so, but thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I had an intention that you might have cuts to offer up. Did you want to use
that? You want to talk about that? Okay, you know,
some of those that
I don't have anything firm. What I am talking about right now is district court has long ordered books Okay, it's a little outdated. We can access most of it online. The problem with working with this agency, and I won't name it here, is that it's kind of like cancel my contract and I get $10 savings on $1,000 for the one book I wanted. I get 50 books for 950 bucks, or I can get one book for
Is
850.
this different than Westlaw? You have books versus online access to.
Yeah, there's some books that we need basically handheld that we can take into court that function that are fairly expensive, but we have a budget of close to 20 something thousand dollars in terms of books. And some of it are update to case laws that are easily accessible online now. And we don't need all of that. And I started engaging them in this conversation, try to be a responsible department or official. And I tried to engage them in this conversation at the end of last year. And it was less than easy to deal with them. And I am thinking, and I need to work with your department to cancel the contract and then renew it and see where we can negotiate from there, because there's no way to effectively reduce the number of things that I require physical books for, and I can cancel and have a reduction in the actual budget that is equal to what I'm reducing, if you understand what I'm saying. So I'm continuing to work on that. As I get more information, I can anticipate that we might be able to cut that budget significantly for the board. Okay. It's about time.
The Superior Court Law Library is down to no books. They're fully electronic.
Yeah. And that's the I think what you're talking about, and that's fairly easy, is the actual case law books. And that's what I'm talking about. Okay. It's what I guarantee you that the Superior Court judges are not down is that volume, that's court procedures that they walk into court with and reference on their bench. And they're pricey, and there's advance sheets and things like that that they probably would not have reduced that keep them apprised of updates and laws and things like that.
I'm just curious because this came up the other day in a different department. What do you do for interpretation? And do you have
Oh, interpreters, we have a fund, and there we haven't made a huge ask. We had to deal with some of the computer systems in that ask. I don't know if they've been fully ironed out, but our interpreters come from a professional fund, and our interpreter fees are astronomical, and they've gone up astronomically in the last year. Is in addition to mediation costs too that we pay for. But the interpreter fees have gone up significantly. And we're going to wait to the end of the year to table off to see where we are in relationship to that fund, because it's one big pool that we tap from for everything from
Just
mediation
oh, for all
to
your professionals.
security to you name it. Yeah.
Just to be clear, they went up from $111,000 to $120,850.
So what's in the budget? That's what's reflected in the
And we
budget.
weren't, when we made that first request, we weren't able to make that request. Apparently, that was blocked out. We couldn't make the increase in the professional funds. It looks like we've worked out the issue, and we did make an increase in
But
ask.
still, it's only less than 10% over a year.
Yeah.
It's not astronomical, in my opinion.
But
Not what we're asking for. But what the fees actually are, we recognized, and see, this is the fiscal restraint that we try to exercise ourselves.
I hear what you're saying. I understand
When
now.
we saw that there was a deficit or the increase in fees, and we saw that we had reserves that weren't used in prior years, we didn't make necessarily a correlated increase in requests.
One clarifying question, and then I apologize. I should have seen
Okay.
this earlier. You talked earlier about the intergovernmental support you do to the city of Langley, Coopville, Oak Harbor. In 2024 and 2023, we budgeted 284, then 244, and then suddenly it dropped in 25 and 26 to 125,000 in budgeted revenue. Where did that revenue go?
I increased that back up to 225
Okay, so
after
that's
talking
changed
with the
since our
court.
book. Okay, so there is additional revenue there. Okay,
Okay,
thank you.
and I should say something on revenue. Okay, and I'd be remiss if I didn't, because it affects you. We're not in the revenue collection business.
No,
Okay, and
I
I understand, and I'm not saying you're saying
that
that.
was
Okay,
intergovernmental, but
but
thank you for saying
I
that.
had to say it. But I will tell you this.
That was
Our
intergovernmental.
revenue stream is one of the parts and the problem we have with the retention level, the training needs, the understaffing, is that our collections from 2023, I didn't discover it. I changed the policy on it. In 2023 are what they call FTAs, where we remit this to collections or we give a person a last chance to pay. They weren't being serviced. We didn't have enough resources to handle that. We recently made a drive to take our clear up that backlog. In fact, my administrator, because no one else was available, had to take that responsibility on. And we have seen a significant increase in revenue, but I'm only mentioning this because it underscores what happens when you're understaffed. Our revenue stream, as you can see, was about $200,000 less in 2023, but it had a significant drop, some related to a case law that came out, other related to the fact that there wasn't a lot of follow-up on the best way to part is FTAs and things like that, where you're actively engaged in collecting what's been court-ordered or required by statute. Okay, and so we're working on that. We've almost got rid of over half the backlog at this point in time. And so that should impact the bottom line for the county. But again, that's not our business. We're doing it because we need to catch up on almost 2+ years of backlog. And so we started to work about that a month ago.
Thank you for letting us know that.
Okay.
Anything else?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. And again, have a good afternoon.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, Susan.
Great. I've provided and I'm just going to go through the notes that I made before the meeting to update you on where we are with the budget process. So I did provide you updated sheets for the supplementals, which we'll get to here soon.
Is that reflected in the book or is it something you handed?
It's in your book.
It's in the
that
821 document.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So that's in the book. So when we get to that, we are continuing to reconcile the CIP in ClearGov. So we have every time we've had an update to it, we've updated ClearGov, and then we have to import that information and reconcile it, make sure that it is accurate. So we're still in the process of doing that after yesterday's meeting.
Thank you for that.
Personnel edits need to be made for public health and public works. Public works talked about positions they're not filling, so those need to be edited out of the budget. And then with public health, we realized that the Clean Water Utility Fund, the way those activities are being recorded after talking to the auditor, they should be coded directly to that fund and not journal entried over. And so they're booking it over and it looks like their wages, but it's actually a journal entry. And that's a part of a bigger conversation about the Clean Water Utility.
Yes, we're going to have that. Or because when I went through the public health budget and then the spreadsheet that said what was on clean water utility, I was a little bit confused between their presentation of what I thought they thought was on clean water utility and the number of public health positions that are actually on clean water utility. And I guess, and this is more of a public health conversation, but I don't remember being asked to put those positions on clean water utility. I remember conversations about we have budget capacity to expand in these areas, but I maybe, and I'm, you know, this is a little bit on me, but a little bit also on the way things are presented. I assume that that was foundational public health capacity. I didn't know it was clean water utility when we started expanding divisions. And so I'm a little bit more concerned about that fund, not just from a financial standpoint, but from an addition of staff that's got salaries on it. We were basically told that we were using it to backfill salmon recovery. We're using it to backfill like six positions.
It'd be really helpful to know which in the same way I think about attract changes to look at that fund and in attract changes, which positions were changed and which ones pre-existed, because that was somewhat confusing to understand.
From the data and from looking at Finance Enterprise and drilling down on the journal entries, it's difficult for me to see the calculations behind that. It's much cleaner and clearer to code the employees that are supposed to be paid for out of that fund in that fund. Then you know exactly who that is. So I need to work with public health to identify what those are. I need to make those programming changes in ClearGov to be able to have a fruitful discussion with the board regarding who's being coded there, how much is being coded there. I do have a spreadsheet that I received from Colleen Jokinen in Public Works, who has been working with Public Health on the Clean Water Utility Fund to balance that fund out. I had just seen it earlier this week. I hadn't seen it before this meeting. And so as we dig down into the whys, there was some older information provided to staff and public health on how to account for this information that was not accurate and needed to be updated. And that's why I'm not able to provide good information to you on this piece of it.
I mean, part of where it's important too is that if there's not a critical areas planner on that fund, we can put a critical areas planner on that fund and get it off that permit fund that's in the red.
Correct.
But right now, all that capacity is being used up for things that I don't think the board knew it was being necessarily used for. And we might want to make a different decision that says you will fully fund this from this program or existing FPHS dollars. And you might have to make other cuts somewhere else because we need that clean water utility money out of there. And I don't like it when those choices get taken away from the boards, especially in these kind of environments where we're trying to get operational capacity. I don't want to just pass on fee increases to the public when we have some cost controlling measures and reallocation of fund measures within our control. And so I'm a little bit concerned about the expansion that happened on that fund.
There's significant programming for capital projects through Public Works, and then there's significant programming for health. Though the fund itself brings in $1.5 million a year, but as we look out in the six-year plan and we calculate out some health increases, the fund can't support what's programmed there today.
Right. But I'm going to need justification for why drinking water is on the fund. I want to understand why on-site septic's on the fund, because that's a permit. I mean, there are things that that fund appears to be paying for partially for employees that I'm not understanding how they got used and if that fund got used in that way for those positions versus paying fully for the critical areas planner, which is something called out in the program itself.
Yes.
And also, that could also explain a little bit why that permitting fund all of a sudden had a problem, because we weren't billing to the fund that was supposed to be covering some of the expenses. You just added something to there and put it on the permit revenue, and that wasn't how that was originally intended to be funded.
Due to the turnover in planning was unaware that that was a place where we would code something like that. So there's enough here with this alone. I think it needs to be brought back for a budget session, Public Works, Public Health, and possibly planning along with that to have that discussion about what are we programming into the Clean Water Utility Fund.
Yeah, good idea.
So I would like to put that on the September 3rd budget workshop. If we can get that all coordinated by then, that might be a push. But with that, that conversation, which is a big conversation and a big reshuffle, the REIT consolidation, so moving all of the REIT 2 projects over to REIT 1, actually adopting a resolution that says we're going to combine those funds, I would like to request that we consider, you consider adopting the budget in December, the first Monday of December, because there's a significant amount of work that needs to be done and decisions by the board before we get to that. We had on the schedule to adopt the budget on
October 6th.
October 6th. So I don't, unless we could turn this around by the 4th of September, I don't have enough time to publish and produce final schedules for you to review in that time.
Is there anyone from planning on the call up there?
Stephanie anyone? Montgomery.
Stephanie.
And Jonathan is at home.
Okay. My question is, at this moment in time, and maybe this isn't a question that we want to ask in this venue, you guys tell me if we should say nope. Are we going to be able to pass a comprehensive plan in December, or is that going to be stretching out into next year?
Next year.
It's going to be next year, you think?
I
because
know,
part of the reason, of course, wanted to do this was because we wanted time with the comp plan.
Yep.
But if we're stretching out the comp plan, then it makes it a little easier for us to stretch out the budget as well.
I mean, the Oak Harbor delay, they haven't even like totally accepted what we've said to them. So we're just not going to be able to get all the work and the code amendments and all the stuff done to adopt this year. I mean, the timeline I've heard is like February, March.
By rules, did the legislature not give us an additional 6 months? Beyond December,
I
my record.
We got from June to December, but as long as you're working on the comp plan, you're not in trouble. And I think they've been communicating with Commerce about an updated timeline. But we basically aren't here in November because of all the other regional meetings we have to retreat us all up. So, and then we have 2 weeks in December, and we don't, out of respect for the public, make big policy changes the last couple of weeks of December.
December 23rd.
We're in next year, right? And so I think to your question of like how much comp plan work are we going to have, I think we're going to have a lot by the nature of even getting done in February, but we're not going to adopt. I would be shocked if I were wrong. In fact, I'd wager something on it. Like, we're not going to be done.
Jonathan, are you able to unmute and
keep talking?
Yeah. Yeah, if you could unmute and address this for us.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. We hear you.
Great. When we were chatting about the reassessment, and I think it's correct what Commissioner Johnson was saying, with the reassessment of the numbers for the population projections, we will most likely be just having to extend that adoption time to beginning of next year. So that's correct.
And by beginning, we're thinking February-ish?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that the citizens are going to want us, if you guys could come up with a plan, they're going to want to know, because this moratorium business, right? They're going to want to know when
Correct.
The moratorium can be expected to be lifted. Okay. Then, commissioners, do you have any opinion about what Susan has requested to move adoption to December?
Rather do it right than do it quickly if we can.
I need until December personally, just because I'm still adjusting to the ongoing capacity shortfall number and trying this just for my own vote, trying to process how much of that will go under fund balance as a drawdown, how much of that is going to need to be reduction of expenses, where those for reassignment of expenses to other funds and what those program areas look like. And I mean, that's taking a little processing for me. And then also, I mean, whether we like it or not, there are supplementals. You know, there are things that we still have to invest in, technology being one, right? We can't just not do the cybersecurity work. We can't just pretend like we don't have progress happening. So there are things we do have to allocate resources towards, and then figuring out what those really are and where that funding comes from. It's just a little bit harder to constrict than it is to add programs. And I personally just need a little more processing time and creativity time to try to figure out how to do that in a way that's least impactful to people. And I'm sure I'm not alone in that. We're all trying to be creative to make it least impactful to people.
And for me, and I'm sure you guys will feel the same way, I'm anxious for us to be able to adopt whatever we can associated with what is ASBILT. Is it 1250? I've forgotten the name of it. But the one that would allow us to perhaps be able to afford to pay for public defense and some other law enforcement issues. And so the prosecuting attorney is bringing that to us on September 17th. For our first discussion of what our options are. And so that would make it very difficult for us to be able to adopt a budget on October that would include any of those expectations.
We
As well as planning fee increases.
That's right.
We have to get the fee
we
increases
have
in our
a
plan.
number of revenue questions that may, even with the new extended deadline, not be done. So we may have to parking lot some of those conversations dependent on, because all we would be doing is if we have time to apply by the end of the year, doesn't mean we can guarantee the revenue by the end of the year.
That's for the grant portion.
Yeah.
There's the other councilmatic portion.
We could
Oh,
adopt.
that piece, yes.
And so if we're going to do that, how much lead time? What does that mean? When does that go into effect? And do we factor that revenue into the budget?
Yes.
And we need to hear from the PA's office about timeline and process there to
That's
know
right.
when that revenue could go into effect or if. So we got some balls in the air.
December. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. With that, then we'll go ahead and work on that, and I'll work with the your clerks to probably have a few more budget work sessions pushed out to have some of these discussions. But with that today, we were going to talk about budget and supplemental discussions. What I wanted to provide to you, and I've already provided in the fund balance section, at the beginning of the budget process, I had given you the list of positions that were placed on hiring hold.
Yes.
And you wanted to wait until later in the process to discuss those positions, or they were on a one-year funding. So if we could have that discussion now, currently we're at a, let me pull that sheet up for current expense. Ongoing, so the net revenue and expense, income expense right now is a negative $1.3 million. There are a few items that help to offset that. There's an additional transfer to GMA. There was fund balance set aside for the GMA transfer, but the transfer for next year is larger than what was the set aside was, so it requires another $200,000 and some change to make that transfer. So that gets deducted from that 1.3. There's $360,000 in sheriff vehicle set aside. The message I got from the board was that you wanted to continue setting aside money for the sheriff vehicles. So the sheriff vehicle purchase has been included in the budget, so it is part of that 1.3, but the set aside isn't. And so there's still money that will be left over after the lease payment next year, but that set aside is 360,000. And it's exactly what was set aside for 2025.
What's budgeted for public defense?
800,000.
And is 800,000 going to be enough?
It's actually just under.
Yeah.
So we've
That was
budgeted
around there.
900,000.
And that's
Well,
it.
that's just on the public defender.
Conflict. Oh, just on the conflict.
No, just on the public
Well,
defender.
we had increased the conflict
Yeah, that's
from,
it.
yes.
So is that in the 1.3 or no?
It is.
So all the ongoing costs associated with public defense are already in the 1.3.
Correct.
And then we're adding another $250,000 to that. So now we're at 1.5 negative, and then we're adding another 300,000-ish. So we're at 1.8 negative.
I think it's going the other way.
No, it's the other way. So I'm subtracting the one times.
I mean, what I'm hearing is that if we adopted the 1%, we're pretty much even, the 1%, and that picks up the public defense minus those two things that she said come off the 1.3. What I'm hearing is that we're pretty stable.
I'm lost on how those things came off the 1.3. So if we're putting in a transfer for like vehicles, let's take vehicles, that's coming from, you're moving that from fund balance over to operating one time, or we're saying that's an ongoing movement that's going to happen every year.
That's an ongoing
So
movement.
that's operating then, and it would reduce our. With, that's not a transfer in, that's a pull down from. So that gets us to 1.5. See what I'm saying?
Okay.
Am I not
This
tracking?
becomes really complicated when we hold things in fund balance, and then so that this change with the leases. The leases are now budgeted
In operating.
in operating.
Yeah.
So that lease is 400 and get you an accurate number, $430,700 for next year. So that transfer to the motor pool to pay those leases is now in the budget because that is an ongoing expenditure. It will be if we sign those leases, which is in process.
I guess I thought because the sheriff said he had money in fund balance from last year he didn't spend.
He does. He
So
does. So at the this year he would have, he's not spending until he signs the lease. Hold on one second.
I get it. What I'm asking is, because I think you're about to not answer what I'm asking. If we move, if he has $300,000 in there right now, my understanding is that when they sell some of the cars and whatever, it's like a $240,000 expense, right? So we have money to cover this year's operations. If we move $300,000 into that fund again,
So they had at the end of 2024, they had 164,000
left in the fund.
left in the fund.
Oh, he thinks there's a lot more than that.
But the board authorized for 2025 to move 360,000
Okay, now I'm
in
on
the set
track.
aside.
Yep.
Okay. If the lease gets signed this year, the cost will be 282,850, but there will be an offset for the sale of the car. So I will
Right.
keep track of that with this.
But the sale of the car should go back into that fund then that he has.
Right.
Because the sales pitch is that the sale of the fund is what's offsetting the increased cost every year.
Right. But I don't know what that is yet. So we don't have that revenue in yet.
Oh,
In his
okay.
budget,
So
though.
it'll be something less than the
282,850.
But I guess what I'm saying for the board is we don't need to transfer $300,000 if we're going to get, if he's selling seven cars. If we got 100,000, I'm not getting 100,000 per car. That was crazy math. If we're getting $10,000 per car, we're transferring $70,000 into that fund. We would only need to transfer over X amount of money.
That's for this year.
Right. And then next year, he's going to sell seven more cars. We're going to have the fund balance that's in that account to move over. I mean, I think that. The most that we had outlaid was that last fourth year. And that was almost the difference between what we spend normally and what the extra cost is should be what's in fund balance if we keep replacing and we just make this stable lease payment as it goes. That should be absorbing the increase every year. So fund balance should be absorbing this year. This year should be like $141,000 or $240,000 or something. I think it was 100 something this year when you got the sale of the cars back into that fund. So if we just budget operating for a certain amount and let that other fund build up year after year with the sale of the cars, that most expensive year should be offset by what's in that fund. But we shouldn't have to add 300,000 to that fund and pay for that lease every year.
Well, the pull down for the lease would have been part of that calculation. This is how I understood how you wanted to account for it. And I apologize if I didn't get it correct.
I'm not being critical. I was trying to make sure I understand because this first year we were going to end up with more money than we paid out. And so we banked that money. So it shouldn't cost us 300,000 plus the lease payment. The what's in that fund should pay the dollar amount. And then the new cars, this is what they sold us. The new cars are supposed to generate enough revenue to go into that fund and keep replenishing that fund.
Right.
Rather than using those new cars to pay down the lease this year, we're banking the money from those new cars. We have this first year paid for
Fund
in
balance.
fund balance. Is that how anybody else understood it? Because that's how I understood what
It was going
happened.
to save us some money too. At the very beginning, it
Is
was going to
it
save us some
possible
money,
to,
not long term.
if long term, we were if we save that car money up and didn't recycle it during the current year, we should have enough money that fourth year, fifth year to ensure that our payment amount is consistent. That's how I
Yeah, I
understood
remember
it.
that.
That's how I sold myself, at least. So if that's wrong, we need to learn how this works one more time.
Is there a way we can assign a code to this particular the leasing and vehicles so that for these very reasons that the commissioner is raising, we can, because it is confusing with tracking revenue from the sale of the cars, tracking lease payments in this multi-year. It would be nice if we could just pull it up and track it as a separate.
That's actually already in place in the motor pool fund. So there's a sheriff's office vehicle capital replacement plan in there. So when we budget for the expenditure, it comes out of there. The transfer goes into there. Any sales for
Goes
vehicles
into
go into there.
I also think we have a motor pool conversation because I'm going to put that in the CF category of management. I'm not going to figure out, tell you what that stands for.
Okay.
Anybody who knows my vocabulary can figure it out. But I have had conversations with a couple department heads who want to order, like their vehicles need to be replaced. And they have been paying into motor pool, and motor pool saying there's not capacity in there to replace these
Wow.
fund these cars. And so they're asking for current expense vehicles, but motor pool was supposed to be charging rates in a way to replace these vehicles. So I don't know where this mo motor pool money went. I don't know if we weren't charging enough. I don't know why a department that has been paying for a basically a single use vehicle, right? So they've been using this vehicle the whole time and have been paying into this fund the whole time. Where that vehicle replacement revenue went. And my worry is that we did not charge enough, that we were not collecting it, and that the departments thought that they were going to have a buildup associated with their vehicle, and it's not there, and we're going to get asked to replace these vehicles as supplemental asks. And
Without a funding source.
without a funding source, because the motor pool revenue, and we think that we were paying that to these current expense departments and they were paying it. So, for example, parks that gets current expense, I don't want to buy a park truck if what we were doing was paying parks to pay their mileage to the motor pool to replace the vehicle. Current expense is not interested in paying twice. You know what I mean? Said calmly. but a little bit concerned.
Your concerns are valid. When I, of course they are,
Yeah.
right?
No, sometimes they're not. Sometimes I'm just
Well,
mad.
my measure is I turn to the fund balance pages, and I look at what's the balance there, compared to what is the value in the motor pool in vehicles? How many are there? Which I would have to build an analysis on. I'm sure that facilities has one, and I can take a look at it. But there's only 300,000 basically in that fund, and that would not replace all of the
Oh,
vehicles
geez.
there. So building a model to say this is what we have, this is what we really need. This is what we need to replace right away. What can we push up? How long do we want our vehicles to last? That's a model we keep in-house. A leasing models is different, obviously, and they've provided some examples of how that works. But putting it to a schedule, like I wrote down sheriff vehicle schedule, taking that model, and we're going to have to make some assumptions
Yeah.
about how much we'll get for those vehicles when we sell them back. And I think that Enterprise probably has a pretty good idea what that would be on today's dollars. And so we can use that as an example and then see if does that schedule really build out the way we think it will? Because they're also going to sell our existing vehicles that
Right.
right? But we won't get the value necessarily from those that we get with the three, excuse me, the f three or five, was it 5 year turnover? 5 year turnover.
5 year for sheriff. I think four was for our fleet.
So I don't think we'd get the we'll get we won't get the dollars on the
Payable.
older vehicles, but I'll work on that analysis to bring forward so that we're sure that this is the right decision for the county. So back to this conversation. I'm trying to help identify the ongoing capacity. So looking at the 1.3, and Jill, you are really good at how to pull the one-time items out. And I'm trying to follow your example with that.
You suck up with the compliment. You know I'm back in the game
I'm learning.
now. Being predictable. I don't know why I'm so hard for people.
So I guess what I'm hearing is we don't want to do the set aside with the sheriff vehicles. There's money in there already.
That's what I'm hearing.
Okay.
I don't want to pull from that money necessarily. I want to let that money keep building to help with that painful year.
Okay.
But what we should budget operationally is what we should expect the lease payment
To
to
be.
be kind of in an
A
ongoing way.
net.
Yes.
Okay. That's fair.
Predicting out building a what I hear you saying is building a balance for that fourth year out when we see a
It's
spike.
similar to what we did for IT when we were building the IT equipment fund, is we were putting money in for immediate replacement, which is what I think the current year lease payment is. And we were setting money aside for this kind of revolving thing. We had to build up both at the same time. We had to pay out and we had to build the fund. And that's kind of what we need to do right now, is that the offset that the lease is giving us, saying, oh, but it won't be that much, we should save that offset so that when we get to a certain point, this lease will just kind of, we'll just
It'll
have a
roll.
consistent amount we're paying, and that saved up amount will get us over the hurdle. I'm not describing that well, but in my mind, it made sense.
I understand. I think I understand.
There was a very clear picture in my mind, but that doesn't translate in words.
So the 1.3 million does include the lease,
Okay.
the full lease. It doesn't include the money back. So we could probably reduce that transfer for that. I will need to figure out what we think that would look like.
Is it a conservative decision to not put in the money that we're getting back and just leave it in at the lease, knowing that we're gonna, because we don't know how much is gonna come in?
Yeah.
Is it a good conservative decision to just not make that decision right now until we have more accurate information of what that money back in would look like. Because you've said multiple times, we don't really know how much is coming back in.
Right.
And we do know that at this point, our requests are way exceeding our capacity.
So we can reduce the transfer by the income that we have to the motor pool, so that nets out. And then we can set that money aside in current expense. So right now we're showing a transfer of 430,700. When the actual revenue comes in, and I don't do those transfers until the end of the year, we can net that, and then I can account for it on our fund balance page. Thoughts?
So if we do that, then what's our deficit?
So we wouldn't take that 1.3, or that we wouldn't consider the 360. So I would take that out.
So now we're at 1 million.
Well, no. Well, hold on.
I'm not exactly tough math.
We were at 1.3 with the lease payment in.
Right.
Where we got sidetracked is that when we moved money over from fund balance, you reduced the 1.3 by
Three
three.
six. So it's really, if we're using the fund balance that we already set aside, then the ongoing capacity is preserved, right?
Right. But right.
But the
It's kicking the
variance,
can down the road. So
yeah,
then there's going
this.
to be a year where we have a 400 and some thousand dollar transfer. That's what we wanted to avoid. So just to budget in like an even amount. So maybe if they have that projection, if we build that fund balance up to whatever the amount needs to be to keep the ongoing operating stable, and we have enough in that fund balance to transfer over for that offset, that's what our number is. Whether if we can take the car revenue back and reduce operating annually, that's great. If we have, but this first year, we're probably going to need to put that car sales into fund balance to build it up to the 400,000 or whatever it is. That's what I'm trying to say. So I think we just budget for the lease payment for the first year and then put everything in that reserve. So that final year where it's so painful, 5 years from now, where it's so painful that that capacity exists and we're just basically operating on a lease payment. Because even if we build it up a little higher, next year is going to be this year's lease payment plus next year's lease payment.
Right. It is as it'll escalate each year. So
It's just to get through the 5 year hurdle. And then it should just be. Because they're selling the cars for maximum value to offset the difference, blah,
right.
blah.
So this first year lease payment this year is going to be somewhere under 282, 850. So there'll be an offset. You've put aside
360 right now.
this year, right? So 164 plus 360 set. Yeah. So 524 is what you have set aside. Sorry.
It's okay.
524, but.
Sorry, you're saying so the deficit is at how much then?
It's at 1.3.
I know that, but after this last little interaction that we just did, we take the 524 off of the 1.3
When you say
CFO.
deficit, are you
Well,
referring to use
you
of
wanted
fund
to
balance?
contain
I'm
that.
talking about
talking about
us being
that
current
statement.
expense
Yeah.
whole.
The use of fund balance we have to pull out of.
1.3. You
Yeah.
didn't use any fund balance to offset it. So we're
Right.
at one, you put the lease payment into the 1.3.
Yeah.
We're paying the lease payment without a current with a set aside offset. So we're still at 1.3
Okay.
shortfall.
But it's
Right.
we're not taking out of fund balance. Okay.
Okay,
Right.
1.3.
All right,
We're short
1.3.
1.3 in operating.
Okay, let's.
So if that's the case, if we are eligible to do the sales tax.
1.2 in revenue.
Right.
That's basically what
That
the
would
question
help.
is.
Yeah. Did I just stress you out? And then we can do the public
Yeah, a
defense,
little
which is
bit.
included in this. So then that would cover the public defense.
I guess the way I want to have the conversation and why it stressed me out is that we have a almost $900,000 increase in law and justice spending because of the Supreme Court decisions and other things.
Yep.
So when you say what what stressed me out was we said we have a $1.3 million use of fund balance we have to do to make this budget balance. And when you said 1.2, 1.3, it makes it look like we're using the 1/10 of 1% to balance the budget. But what we're using that 1/10 of 1% to potentially do if we make that decision is to offset the extraordinary cost that the Supreme
Exactly.
Court's decision on caseloads made, as well as some additional costs without even considering yet the supplemental request, because they're not in the budget,
Or the future cost of the operating the jail.
or the future costs or any of that. So all what we're actually in consideration of is being put in the unfortunate position to have to do a councilmanic 1/10 of 1% in order to cover the public defense costs, because that's the majority of what that's going to cover.
Yep.
If we just say, I mean, reason where I'm like, here's the difference, and I said it kind of cavalierly, and I appreciate what you just said. We said lease payments for sheriff's vehicles, and we said public
Well,
defense.
defense.
And
That's
those two numbers alone
yep.
add up to the 1/10. And that's not looking at cost escalation of salaries and wages. If
That's
it's
right.
law enforcement, it's not looking at
That's right.
increased demand for law enforcement. It's not the conversation we just heard from district court related to law enforcement. I mean, just the two things that went into our budget that we have no choice on, public defense and sheriff vehicles, is 1.2.
Yes. Yes. And I guess that's why you looked at me and I was stressed out, because
Yeah, I hear you.
that I'm 100% with you that just those two items where we have no choice. Well, we do. We have a choice to look for that kind of revenue and consider that choice, or we have a choice of changing level of service across the whole organization in order to balance a budget,
Or we just
or in law
say keeping
enforcement.
it in law
And
enforcement,
so
that's why we're here.
there aren't a lot of good choices before us, and we must make those two choices, unless the state or the county wants to suspend people's constitutional rights to a defense.
No, that's a federal government's job these days.
Okay,
Yeah, we're likely. I was very
you
sardonic,
need to
please.
say Jill voice.
I hope that my sarcasm is not ill-placed. So now I'm back without being stressed out.
At the 1.3, there have been, we've had conversations. I'm sure you've had conversations with my colleagues too about funding that we can use to offset some things that are on current expense, keep freezing some of the positions we've already froze that are on current expense. Are any of those decisions in the 1.3 shortfall, or we can still make those decisions to reduce that 1.3?
You can still make those decisions. Those are your decisions. I mean, I can discuss it with you individually, but you have to make that decision here.
So one of the things you started with today was that we discovered that there were certain positions in public works, for example, that are going to come out of the budget that are not yet out.
But those are all in the road fund.
Those are all in road fund.
But you and I had some conversations, and again, I'm assuming you had them with my colleagues. You and I had some conversations about how REIT 2 is eligible for infrastructure planning, and that we have positions that are highly focused on infrastructure planning and funding that we thought we could move to REIT 2. Okay, so apparently that's conversations happened everywhere. So those conversations are, is that potential reduction of current expense to REIT in the 1.3.
It is not.
No,
So
not yet.
that's where I'm saying the party is still possible, Susan.
Yes,
Because
totally.
and then there were some positions we froze that we want to get back on the books, but we still need to freeze
You still need to look at them and decide to freeze them.
because it is, and I hope department heads understand this statement without hearing it different. They might hear it different, but it is a lot easier to not hire someone than it is to fire someone or lay somebody off. It's really called laying them off. But if you're the one on the other side, it feels like that's what happened to you. It's a lot easier to say, we're not going to fill these positions right now and deal with the hardship of drug lead than to sit somebody down and say, I'm sorry, you can't make your mortgage payment next month, but we can't afford to. I think that we are moving every stone to ensure that we do not have to have that conversation with existing employees or too many existing employees,
Yes.
right? I mean, we may have to have a few, but they will be very specific about if the funding stream went away, that's where we'll have that conversation, right? But from that 1.3, we still have those frozen conversations, the maybe we consider not refilling positions that are posted right now till we're through the budget process to make sure we have budget capacity before we bring new people on. That could be something we look at. I mean, just to make sure we don't get ourselves in a situation where we're furloughing or laying people off. Again, unless they've lost part of their funding stream. And then that difficult conversation has to happen. We are not in a position to pick up and backfill those salaries with current expense right now, even if you're our favorite person in the world,
Correct.
which is sad.
You said you wanted to ask us about positions, specific positions that were on hold so that the board can make a decision
For 2026.
for 2026, and you want that today.
That would be great.
So can you go through those positions that you were considering that were we left?
So there's
We
two.
left on the books, but that we may need to say, no, we're going to, and they're unfilled positions that are on hold, correct?
They are. So there's that. And then there was also things that were placed on one-time funding. And so making decisions on those. I can start with the positions for consideration if you'd like to make those first. There was one accountant in the auditor's office that was left still unhired.
I'll hold it. Hold it, yeah.
Okay. There is a county administrator.
You were going to hold that.
We're going to hold it.
Okay. Budget and risk, the broadband rural county coordinator.
We're going to move that to we're going to move that position to RCED funding, I
I
thought.
would suggest that.
Yeah, let's move that to RCED.
The coroner, deputy coroner position.
We were going to hold that.
I was going to eliminate that one because she didn't ask for it again.
But yeah,
You want to
let's hold it.
hold
We
it?
don't know what holding it doesn't hurt anything, and who
Okay.
knows what future needs are going to
All
be.
right, we're hold.
It was hard to get that position approved originally.
Well, I think
It just took some
I think I'm fine with holding it.
court reporter.
I don't understand that one and why it's on current expense. So I need to ask some more questions about why it can't be on the judicial fund.
I thought the court. Okay, this is. I'm going to just not say
The
anything because I had a
1%.
memory of it being in a
Yeah, don't
supplemental.
that judicial fund has a pretty good fund balance, doesn't it? Like $3 million, I thought. Why can't it be on that fund? But that is that the JVC fund, if it can't be on that?
Right. That's juvenile detention fund. That's not part of the Superior Court budget.
Is there's no all of Superior Court's on current expense then?
Yes.
There's no other funding source for it? Is there
anything?
We're still on my question, please.
I'm
I'm
still on
sorry.
your question too, which is just if
Okay.
the, but go ahead.
The court reporters have been fu funded through current expense. I can't think of another funding source for that. I can ask Megan.
I mean, if there's not, then I'm okay. Megan.
My question was if juvenile justice fund pays part of what happens in Megan's budget, could we not move something else from on the juvenile justice fund in order to
Free
cover,
up the cost,
free
right?
up the cost? That was my question. And maybe it's an offline question that we can explore.
She's probably not paying attention. She just has her name up there, so we feel pressured. No, she's faking it, so we feel pressured.
Can we, the ju juvenile, go ahead.
Hey.
Sorry, I'm about to leave the office. I just heard Megan.
Megan, we're asking you if there's some expense that you have in Superior Court that you could put on the Juvenile Justice Fund that would allow us to put your second court commissioner.
Court
Court order
order.
back in place.
No.
Okay. Can you look harder when you're back in the
My answer is probably not going to change. Most of the grants and everything that we receive goes towards juvenile court services. Other than, yeah, I can't think of anything. I can look harder, but I wouldn't expect that my answer is going to change.
Could you put the court reporter in courtrooms that involve children in any way? So, parental disputes, divorces,
Custody, child welfare.
custody, child welfare, would that be a
The court reporters are in those hearings.
So can we?
That's what we're saying. And
That's
so
what we're trying to
doesn't
do.
that make it eligible to use your JVC money where we have a $3 million fund balance?
N no.
I
Oh, well,
still hear that.
I would have to have more of a conversation with Susan, but that is a
Jail and juvenile detention
yes,
source.
only yes.
Yeah.
Always an interesting dilemma. I've heard, well, thank you.
Thank you,
Okay.
Megan.
Keep looking,
But
Megan.
so with that, the jail and juvenile detention fund, you have jail costs in current expense. Are there things in the jail that you
Right.
could move over to the JDC fund?
That's what Janet was at.
That's what
That's what
I'm trying
Janet
to
said.
get to,
Okay.
right? So
That's what we're
that
looking for.
is something we should
If we could
examine.
offset so we end up at the net, we can put that one back. Because they're the only one who's really asked us for their position back. But otherwise, I'm a hole. If we can't get the
Yeah.
offset, then we've got I'm a hole.
So my yes would be yes, we would love to fund the court reporter if we can free up funding elsewhere in order to make that work.
That's a political way of saying we're going to hold. Don't find money.
Well, if we get into jail,
Right.
someone in the jail,
Something in the jail to
yeah.
shift that over. And it may, you know, it may not be a person. It may be an expenditure that
Sure,
would be fine
that's
to
true.
move over there as well. But it's an ongoing expenditure,
Yeah.
obviously. So we can take a look at that. So it's for now, it's on hold until we examine that piece of it. There's a deputy in the sheriff's office that was on a hiring hold last year.
We still got to hold
He's
that.
got all his other
Okay.
positions he's got to fill for this
And
year.
then the last one was a 0.6 communications specialist.
Oh.
Hold.
Yeah.
Okay. In another fund in last year, I don't know why we did this this way, but in the juvenile detention fund, we put one juvenile detention officer on a hiring hold. And that would be the juvenile detention fund. I don't know if you want to still place it on.
I mean, that fund is fine. So I think that that's not really an issue that we're
No,
worried about right
that's
now.
right. That's
Okay.
right.
They
So
have talked to
that one
Megan
will.
about whether the need still
Yeah,
exists.
if they need it.
Yeah. So I'll make sure that is included in the budget. Those that list is $778,000.
We know
We
it's
have
going to affect
50.
personnel.
So that is significant. Then there are other things that were on the list that were put on one-time funding sources. The first one is DEI evaluation and training for $75,000.
And that was a consultant, and that contract's ended.
Catherine?
It'll be finished this year. Okay.
Okay.
And you'll have recommendations from that. project that will come to the board in order to institutionalize that DEI work. Okay, thank you.
No, that's not an expense for 26.
The merchant, there's two contracts that the board may consider possibly moving to REIT because of what they're working on. One is Merchant McIntyre, and one was Gordon Thomas Honeywell, but is now
Columbia.
I was going to say Pacific.
Yeah, both of them are working on infrastructure projects, so I say REIT.
I agree. If that's a legal use,
if we can do that,
that's what they're doing.
It's certainly just, I think it's certainly something we can do for the federal. I'm less clear about the state, but I 100% think it should be, and we might as well explore it, or it could be split across two fund set sure. funds.
So Merchant McIntyre is $96,000, and Columbia Policy Group is $49,000. Mm-hmm. HRGSA training for $40,000 was put on one-time funding last year.
I think that this is training that's for supervisory training and other similar kinds of significant countywide. Training, countywide training. I would hate for us not to invest in training for our employees if we have the money in the budget.
I mean, we have it in fund balance, especially if we're going to get this ongoing number down, because we're not going to draw fund balance down as much as we've been afraid we were going to have mm-hmm. to. So I think
half.
We do that. I mean, it's even if you use half, it's a fund balance drawdown. So I'm comfortable at that, 40. Or maybe 30. I don't want to go to half yet.
I trade the risk management.
That's right.
It's a risk management investments, because if we have supervisors who are well trained and know how to do their jobs well, it reduces our risk as a county for other things to happen. So I think it's a good investment.
So let's budget 30.
30.
30.
Thank you for the offer, though, Kevin.
Okay, and then we do have 1 year remaining on the position that was authorized for emergency management, and the position is filled, and that $75,000 that will remain in current expense.
I think particularly after the training we had this morning, I think that we understand that, or I understand, I would, they could speak for themselves, that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in emergency management. I would like to see that continue.
I mean, I think even at one time is fine right now. We need to probably try to get that over to ongoing, but we're going to use current expense to absorb ongoing. So it's kind of saying the same thing.
Right.
I agree. And I think based on the training we had, setting some very specific board-directed goals of what we expect in the next
Definitely.
Year.
So in for that, if you consider the additional transfer to GMA was $200,675 more than what was saved in the fund. So that is part of that 1.3. So it's usually considered one time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The EM tech for 75, the hiring freeze.
I'm sorry, wait, I have to go back. The 265,000, you put in you transferred over 265 to ongoing, and the full amount of GMA is in ongoing right now.
Full amount, yeah.
And rather than saying it was a one-time allocation from the pool now.
Right. Just the difference.
Yeah. No, I know.
Just the difference.
Okay.
And
that includes, and I hate this part of our job where we have to ask questions in the public, but that includes the third GMA position that's one time.
That was budgeted through next year anyway, right. I thought.
Through 2020, isn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
Through 2026.
But that's all in operating now.
Right.
Can we put operating being everything but that position and put that position on one time just so we can see it differently? There's ongoing staffing that we're committed to.
Right.
That makes sense.
And then there's the pull down amount, which is really the additional staff support and the any consultants we need. And like if we have to do a SEPA, that's all kind of on the one time. And then the other is the operating.
It makes sense because that's the narrative we were given, which is that position ends at the end of next year, potentially, unless we reapprove
right.
it.
Well, depending on where we're at, but
right. Okay. So that makes sense to me.
Okay.
So I'll figure out what that number is then and change that. It'll be in the all in 100 to 120 range.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There. It's not a huge thing, but it does change our ongoing shortfall from 600 to 500.
Right. So just for giggles, I'll put 120. Okay. So then the hiring freeze of 778,815. I did, after a conversation with Megan Frazier from the court, I realized that I had lumped the Superior Court Commissioner in with the judge pro tems, and he's actually a 0.3 ongoing 12-hour week position. So I had to add that back in. That was 68,000. I'm sorry, that's in the wrong direction.
Okay.
Merchant McIntyre to moving over to Reed. Columbia moving over to Reed. And that means that the draw on current expenses, 244,385. So we're still in the negative, about $250,000.
Well, that's, plus
it's far better.
We're in the okay, maybe I'm not saying. So we're in the negative $250,000 on fund balance, one-time money, and we're still 500,000 on ongoing operating. So we have a, if right now, if we said this is our budget,
mm-hmm.
we're pulling down fund balance by $750,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's before any supplemental decisions.
Correct.
Right.
So I feel like we personally, this is where I'm glad we're taking a little more time, because I think that there's a little more shuffling that might need to happen to try to achieve some of the supplementals aren't particularly optional. I know I should clarify this. You built the IT non-optionals into the operations budget already.
I did.
Yeah. Okay.
So the only request you'll see in the supplementals now is the finance enterprise one. All of the other ones have been dealt with.
Okay.
Yeah, that's, I saw that.
And that's really how much do we want to allocate to save up for amount, right? Because that one's so expensive. Plus the PACs. Any money setting aside to replace that anywhere?
We haven't developed the software replacement set aside schedule, basically.
Because we don't know what we're replacing it with, or because we don't find out.
There's a combination. Well, that probably is the number one reason, but probably not a good one. It's a combination of reasons.
May I ask a question about the SAS that was in the supplemental? It's the one thing that's left in the supplemental.
Which one?
The finance software.
Okay.
I just want to make sure. I see a total current expense of 74K. Then the upgrade to cloud is a one-time of 150, a net cost of 76 on top of the 74 of Cognoscent current budgeted. And then the ongoing I get. So I just want to make sure that what's in that IT supplemental is 74 plus 150. Plus 76.
Well, the 150 would be a one-time fee. That wouldn't be an ongoing.
No, I'm just looking for next year.
If it were done next year.
If it were done next year, yep. Is that the total amount? No, the ongoing annual 128, I'm ignoring.
I'm going to ask IT to come up and discuss this. I don't want to get it wrong.
While we're waiting on that, in the meantime, fund balance sheet showed... I'm switching gears while they're coming up.
Come on up.
Here.
Okay. IT.
In the fund balance thing, the 110 fund has a pretty substantial amount of money in it, and we're putting current expense into human services. I mean, I think we're putting in $50,000, $60,000 or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe I thought we were putting in one full salary, but maybe for some reason, I think it's $50,000, $60,000. Can we get that out and make that fund, that 1/10, cover the cost of human services and get that current expense out of there right now?
I can discuss that with the human services director and see how we can
pick that back up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because that fund balance is healthier than current expense.
Okay.
Okay, now
No, I think that's, it's so hard to notice where we can. It's like having a whole portfolio of accounts, and we have to be able to manage our portfolio to pay for the things in the right order in the right time. So that's a good catch. So my question was in just trying to know what the number was, because there were lots of numbers on that box. And I saw 74,000 for the current budgeted cost plus Cognos. And then I saw 150,000 for the one-time fee to the cloud, plus a net cost of 76,000 means that the total supplemental request for this, if we did this next year, would be 300,000. See, this is why it didn't make sense to me. So you're going to have to tell me what you're actually asking for here.
So right now we are paying $74,000 a year for the software that we are for the continuing licensing of our current software.
Okay, so this is what we are paying.
Yep.
And is in budget.
And it's in budget. The total cost of the upgrade would be $150,000 for next year. That includes our rights to the SaaS service and the cost of the consultant for
That's how you got to the net. You took the 150 minus the 74. That's where you, okay, I'm in the game now. That's how you got to the net.
And
Okay.
that would be based on doing it initially early in the year. Every month we use it, that we erode some of that 70,
It's okay. I just needed to get the math to make sense to me.
Yeah, this isn't a requirement that we do it next year. The software's not going to stop working. The vendor has told us it is end of life next April. Yeah. So that's kind of our warning to us that we need to come up with a plan.
But the net request here is just 76,000,
Correct.
not the 300,000
Correct.
that I was having a hard time with.
Correct.
Okay.
And the one thing to realize is that the following year, our ongoing expenses would go up from 74,000 a year to 128 per year.
And that's where this
27 and 27.
okay. I couldn't make the 76 make
Get
sense
it.
with all those numbers in the column next to it. And it's just I wasn't reading it right. That's all on me. So now I understand what it is. I see it there, but I couldn't make it make sense.
Thank you. And did you have any comments about PACS? No comments about PACS.
I just thought we were talking about if there wasn't a replacement plan, but that what
No.
we were talking about if there was, it was expensive.
It's expensive. I think what we ended up discussing, IT and the board, was a little different than what the assessor and the treasurer wanted. Neither are really requesting replacement. We all just know that it's coming to its the end of its life. So we just decided to sort of build a model so we can save toward replacing it with something.
Okay,
And
so
that's
there
what
is a
we're working
savings
on.
plan.
And we haven't developed the model, but we know we're on the hook to do that.
Okay.
Yeah. And kind of for all the big
So
boxes.
that's on your work plan for next
That's what I was just gonna say.
It will be on our work plan for next
Yeah.
I appreciate when you say work plan and then you show us what you're doing.
I think we're going to be doing the looking at the work plans, what, the second week in December?
September 17th,
We
and
approve
then
them usually
again.
in November.
Yeah.
Right, but we're not around much in November.
Yeah,
What'd you say?
then you have them in December.
Yeah, December is when
We'll do
we'll be doing
2026.
2026 work plans.
So now this isn't real. I mean, it's not real in the sense that it makes any kind of difference. It makes a difference in storytelling and emotion. We have $500,000 set aside in facilities right now. With the combination, and we did that because all the facility repairs and replacements were on REIT one. That's not the case anymore. We don't need to hold that fund balance set aside for facilities in the same way. We could reallocate that to the motor pool startup. We could offset the jail savings with that. And
Where is it set aside, Jill?
I don't know how to deal with this when my watch rings. It's just in our fund balance, and then we call it. So how it's like I say, oh, we have 12 to $14 million. I think we have 12 now, million dollars in fund balance. And Susan says we have four because what we have in fund balance is all these either restricted funds or called out, you know, earmarks. Mm-hmm. And so it's not real. That's why I said it's not real. It's literally like just sitting there in fund balance, but we said it's not eligible.
Is it like a placeholder in REIT one
that we could reuse? We could put it
in something else. Okay. Because of the way when the REIT changed, we don't need that holdout in the same way.
Right.
Okay.
It doesn't give us more money anywhere. It just gives us the mental relief of knowing that we have more
we could
unallocated fund balance.
Although the emergency budget of our CIP, it's fine with it being what it is, but I read that and it seems low, but you're telling me, well, we have other emergency funds available to us if we need it.
What we didn't have when we set that facilities budget up,
yes,
we were having a lot of deferred maintenance and we only had REIT one, and there's a lot of pressure on REIT one.
Yes.
When they combined REIT one and two, it released a little of that pressure off REIT. Mm-hmm. So we don't need to hold that current expense because we needed to make sure that if we got halfway through a project and REIT crashed, we could still like fix the roof but now with REIT two,
I remember the conversation.
We have more capacity. So it's just a mental movement more than anything. It doesn't create new money. It just creates that reality that 500,000
creates.
We could say that we're moving 500,000 to the jail and transferring the facilities money to the jail fund. It's just, it's all the same game. It's just a mental release of 500,000.
It creates flexibility. It's flexible funding as opposed to restricted funding.
That's what it is.
And so by having flexible funding, we can apply it where it's needed as opposed to where it must be spent based on arbitrary law.
Right.
I like that. The flexibility of that is good remembrance.
I'm just trying to find money. And now I found money that's not even real, but I found it.
Do you want to remove that reserve?
Yeah,
I do.
Sure.
I think also it's a good message to facilities that you're living and dying off REIT now.
That's easy.
Commissioner Johnson.
You get that REIT money?
No. I'm responding to your earlier question about PACs. While we have not done anything, we have looked at what other counties have paid recently for it. And don't quote me on the cost, but it was over $1 million for Clark County to move to a new property assessment.
I mean, that's kind of the issue about why you need a healthy fund balance and then also why you need to start saving up. There is an IT fund, right?
IT capital replacement fund.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's where money needs to start going in there, but also it needs to go in there from the treasurer has a, I'm sorry, the auditor, no, the assessor.
I think we need to.
The assessor has a fund. They all have equipment replacement funds. They need, everybody who uses that needs to start putting some money in that. Planning uses it, right, PAX? They get they charge a technology fee. Some of that fee needs to go into that fund to start building these things up. This isn't like, oh, I need something new. No,
those
you've got to save to replace.
Yeah, those that tech fee is set aside in those funds and accounted for. I could get the balances of those, and that those charges are being placed up against that. So that is being tracked.
Right. But what happens with it, because we've seen it happen at this table, is one of the electeds will come in, or I shouldn't even say electeds, or the department head will come in and say, this is how much money I have in the technology fund. Mm-hmm. This is where I want to spend it. And the community also has been highly critical of too much money in those funds. Like I've had builders who've tracked that fund and come in and said, why aren't you using this technology fund to make it more user-friendly for technology? If we transfer money out from that, those technologies fund into the savings account for PACS replacement, it basically says this is our intended use of this money. You know what I'm saying?
So there's two things. There's an actual technology fund that's between the treasurer and the assessor.
Yeah.
But planning and public works and
public health.
Yeah, and public health have tech fees that go into their individual fund balances as assigned. They're separate. They're tracked by job ledgers. So we know how much money is going in. We know how much money is being spent out of it. So there are set asides in each one of those funds for that purpose.
Right.
But we should be talking about what that is.
Right. But what I'm saying is those individual funds should maybe transfer into the savings thing a certain percentage annually, because what happens to the board, at least to me, but it's all of us, but how I process it is that somebody wants something, they say they can pay for it within their technology fund.
Mm-hmm.
We say yes, because you have a want and a way to pay.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, nobody's saving for the future of replacement of this very large system, which some of those fees should be going towards. And that's why I'm saying some of that needs to get out of those funds and be transferred in to every year to this, for the departments that use this system. They need to, some of that money needs to be transferred over. And then we also need to start thinking about how much current expense gets set aside for that. So when the bill comes, you're talking about a $300,000 shortfall or a $200,000 shortfall rather than $1 million shortfall.
And to your point, when we're talking about the planning fund calculation is all of their funding. So that set aside is not counted in that negative.
No, I know.
Right?
Yeah.
So they don't, basically they don't have that set aside.
Right. Oh,
am I
is it negative? They're using it as revenue?
Well, the total fund balance is being used in this calculation here.
For in all what those funds?
The fund balance calculation.
Yeah, okay. Am I hearing you say that when we have these fees going in and they go into the fund balance, that we should be setting up a restricted code that means it allows it, that's a subset of those fees that is meant to develop and grow over time for the big purchases and cannot be used for new costs? Is that what I hear you saying?
I was just going to build, transfer out from the fund into another fund.
A restricted fund.
Another fund grows and is held for certain purposes. I wouldn't restrict it each one of those funds. I would just say, how much money do you plan on needing? We're going to take $25,000 this year and put it in that fund or whatever. It would just be a transfer out of those funds into this other larger combined fund that we have right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just basically billing it and having those funds pay a bill.
That sounds very responsible.
So the planning fund has...
No, it's done. We're at four.
On paper.
You're having a hard time with your words, and that's unusual. So
I know. I'm tired. Thank you.
The planning fund on paper has almost $500,000 in committed fund balance for the tech fee.
Committed for what?
That tech fee.
No, I
but committed to what purpose? To what expense?
Technology improvement. So it pays for, supposed to pay for PACs.
So that's the right. that's the money that I hear Commissioner Johnson saying should be pulled out and held for when we have to buy PACs and not allowed to be used of, I need a tablet because I added an additional permit tech who needs a tablet in the field.
I would take half of it and put it in a different fund and leave some for them to make decisions with, like if they needed to upgrade SmartGov or they, I mean, there are technology things that the department
yeah, I hear
need,
you.
Which is why we have this fee. But I'm also saying that that's not just money to be creative with on a departmental level. It's money that also is supposed to transfer over to be used for big enterprise expenses.
For those every 10-year million-dollar expenses that we come upon us. And I agree. I mean, I translated in my own head, but I agree that the technology fund, yes, it can pay for something that they might need for whatever, you know, technology.
Maybe you are thinking that you just need a ballot sorter and you have technology money for that. And so you buy a ballot sorter and you don't pay into something larger enterprise-wide that the entire
county right.
needs, like the wire that connects all the departments to each other.
And maybe even to take it a step farther, in our financial policies, we can, that are enterprise-wide, we can specify that X percent of those fees that are meant for those every 10-year expenses must be set aside and saved for those enterprise-wide large expenses that'll come upon us. We could actually amend our financial policies to say that we are going to restrict X percent of those kinds of funds for enterprise-wide savings, that so that in 8 years, a future board isn't looking at $1 million cost.
Right. Okay. Can we go back to one other thing? Sorry, then I'm done.
All righty.
Because I'm not making any sense. So
you are actually making sense, and that's good.
Well, Janet, when you're the only one understanding me, I think I might have a problem.
It is after 4 o'clock, I think.
And I'm tired. I want to go back to one thing, to touch on one thing that we talked about earlier, because I'm not sure the board was clear. When we're talking about, I was actually kind of serious about not filling positions that are even being advertised right now. If you are on a fund that has less than 10% fund balance or current expense, I don't think anybody should be filling positions until we're through the budget process.
So
I don't know, but I can't give that direction, and I don't know where the board feels.
I would have felt okay with that if we were going to be adopting the budget in October. Now that we've decided to not adopt until December, I'm a little more hesitant about that.
I'm tired.
Okay. I just don't want to bring somebody on. And so I hate to call out specific things, but like, for example, a paralegal that's unfilled is an easy position for us to pick up current expense on right now. If it's unfilled, once somebody's in that job, it's hard. The sheriff has some, I guess, could keep advertising for his, how many sheriff deputies positions are we having maybe to roll back, or are we not going to roll any back? I mean, there are some of these funds. Planning has a position that they're advertising right now, and planning's in the red. Do we let them hire that position and then say you've got to cut, or do we just not let them hire that position right now till we know if they have fund balance or they have the funding to cover it? And that's why I'm asking, is because once we bring somebody on, I feel like that is a promise to them. It's like a commitment. And so it says, we want you to change your life and come work for us. And if the next conversation is, oh, sorry, we can't afford you, I'd just rather not bring somebody on. And so that's why I was like, if your fund doesn't work or you're on current expense.
How about if we ask HR if she would be able to talk with the different departments that this would apply to and see what the strain would be if they waited to hire until after the budget is?
How's that going to go? You have one department that doesn't absolutely need their person?
Yeah, I can pretty much
tell. In their minds?
Yeah, they're all going to be necessary. Yeah.
I mean, I guess if we think we can do it, I mean, right now, what we have to, if we can accept the fact that we're $750,000 pull down on fund balance and we're going to add supplementals in, we can go ahead and say higher. But I think that number is going to be too high for us. And we have some supplementals that we're still looking at. I just feel like maybe we just hold off on some of the hires for a while.
I'm a little bit, more than a little bit, I guess, confused here. You're saying we still have a $750,000 pull down on fund balance.
Is on that current expense?
For current expense, yeah. Right.
It's what we would have, because we don't have enough ongoing operating capacity, so right. We have to take it from current expense to do the ongoing piece and the one-time piece. That
right.
adds up to about 750.
I understand, but does that include that 1.2?
No, it doesn't. And
that kind of is our saving grace.
Well, if we're able to do that this year, and if we're able to do that, I mean, if we're not, that's why I was kind of leaning towards maybe we just don't hire right now, because if we're not able to do that, this is the financial reality we're facing. If we have that tool to pay for public defense, we're in a different financial reality, and then we can just say, yes, it's okay to hire.
Then how about if we, because we're going to be able to have this conversation with the prosecuting attorney in September to talk
hold
about,
October.
So maybe hold till October. I'm good with saying hold till October. I don't feel comfortable saying hold till December.
All right. I can live with hold till October, and then we can revisit and see where we're at.
I don't have, I hear you both, and I just feel like going through the open positions, I don't have enough information to know where they are in their hiring. Are they doing interviews right? I just don't know where we are and have enough information to feel like I'm making a fully informed decision to hold or not hold.
Well, I think we're talking about probably the ones that are posted right now.
Well, that's what I'm looking at right now.
So there's no interviews on the ones that are posted right now.
But even if there are, if unless somebody's hired, it's better it's better to not marry someone than to get a divorce, right? That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Is that if it's just, I don't want to make a commitment we can't honor, and I'm not confident we can honor all these things at the moment. And again, we've been in positions at the county where job requisitions have come to us. We've said you have to hold until they've paid out their retirement. You have to hold until, or maybe this position gets put on before this position gets put on. We don't have any of those mechanisms set up right now to say this one's essential and we have to do it. This one can hold longer. And so it just feels less arbitrary to just say, if you're on a fund that isn't penciling out, you're not moving forward right now, that includes current expense. But I'm fine with waiting until October. I'm worried about making promises to people and then having to break them.
No, absolutely. I don't believe in hiring someone and the next month saying, sorry, we don't have the money for you. That doesn't.
So
no,
what was your compromise, Commissioner Baker?
My compromise is the beginning of October. We should know. We'll be able to make a statement one way or the other.
Okay. I'm good with that.
So if you're good with that, we're at 2 anyway, but I just want to clarify where we are. And I'm not against for or against it. I just was trying to make. So for example, let's pick an easy one. For example, the plans examiner building inspector position that's currently open, we would say to planning community development, you can keep that open, but you can't make a final decision or offer until October, when the board has got more certainty about budget. Is that what I hear you saying?
That's what I'm saying, but she's shaking her head.
Well, I just, from an administrative perspective, I think we would not have those open for recruitment.
Just
because then we're going to be delaying for 2+ months for people.
And they would just drop off anyway.
Yeah.
And
so I think there's a way we can just kind of archive those for right now. And then just have the ones up that we know are fully funded.
So then I do think we have to be a little more precise because, for example, and I think we talked about this, the veteran service officer, we are already under
grant.
We
have the funding for
that. And we're already moving forward with it. So I would want to let that one move forward as an example.
Sure.
Right. Because what we just said was if you don't have funding or you're on a fund that's in the red.
Yeah. I'm with you now.
Okay.
I'm with you.
You said it in a positive way, and I said it in a negative way. I said it if you don't have funding. You said if you have funding.
That's fair. I just wanted to be clear. I was understanding it because my brain is.
No, you were just positive about it.
Yeah, mine was just an administrative.
Okay. So I hear
announce
that.
This to the folks that are implicated.
So say again what you were saying. If you don't, say it again, Jill.
If you're on a fund. That I was saying that doesn't have 10% fund balance. But if you're on a fund that's in the red or doesn't have enough, if it's a risky fund, current expense being one, planning and community development, we know
is in the red.
if you're on one of those funds, I would not rehire right now till we get the budget stabilized.
So, and I would agree with you that current expense is a fund that is still a risky fund, and we're trying to make it work. So what we're saying is, if your fund isn't balanced right now, if you're in the red in future projections, and or you're in current, these are positions in current expense, we're asking you to hold them. So you will pull them from the recruitment, and we will come back to this on October, the first week in October, or yep, the end of September, to release in October or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand now.
Okay.
Got it.
Anything else?
No.
No. So let me read my script. If nothing more, this meeting is adjourned.
Oh, that's my favorite line of the day.